So H.P. Lovecraft may have been a great writer, but he was also, undeniably, a racist, which pretty much ruins him for a lot of readers and writers. One of the people who has a problem reading Lovecraft because of his racism is Gemma Files. She's a Canadian horror writer, and Steve Paulson caught up with her.
Gemma, are you a fan of H.P. Lovecraft's work?
I'm more a fan of the works that Lovecraft's work has inspired than I am of Lovecraft himself. He has problems above and beyond the obvious. I mean, he never met a piece of exposition he didn't like. He can't write dialogue at all. He nests his narratives so intensely that half the time you have difficulty remembering who's telling you what, about what happened, and when and to who. His language is really exclusionary, even when he's just describing things, and he's a total snob. And then, of course, there's the racism.
Okay, so what do you like about his influence then?
I really like the mythology that he came up with. I really like the idea of an overwhelming universe crushing down on humanity. I mean, I don't like it, but it's very powerful, and it appeals to me on a very specific human level. I think that Lovecraft, at his best, reaches a point of existential dread that all of us understand and all of us can sympathize with.
Yeah. Let me pursue some of the problems that you mentioned having to do with Lovecraft. Now, he was notoriously racist. There's one letter, for instance, where he described New York's Chinatown as, quote, a bastard mess of stewing mongrel flesh.
That's the one.
As a horror writer and as someone who considers Lovecraft an influence, how do you reconcile his racism with his work?
I can't reconcile his racism any more than I could ever ask or expect anyone else to reconcile it. I mean, you could point out that Lovecraft came from an incredibly inbred family, that he had physical issues, which meant he was in pain a lot of the time, and most of his hatred of the people he characterized as barely human was actually fear. But then you sound like you're making excuses. He was a grown-ass man when he said these horrible things. And if he was around today, I'd tell him to own them and that they were utterly unacceptable and that he needs to do some hard thinking about his life and his choices. Unfortunately, we can't do any of that because he's dead.
Yeah.
But what we can do, what I and my friends have already done, is commit to refuting Lovecraft through our Lovecraftiana, to being inclusive and diverse and making our true monsters the human beings who want to treat other human beings like they aren't.
And you've written a short story that appears in a new anthology of Lovecraft-inspired fiction called She Walks in Shadows. And the stories are all about women and all written by women. Your story is called Hair Work. Tell me about that.
Basically, what I did was I took a story called Medusa's Coil, which Lovecraft co-wrote with a woman named Zealia Bishop for Weird Tales. And the thing about Medusa's Coil is that it is, of all the racist stuff that Lovecraft ever wrote, it is one of the most overtly racist. It concludes with what really has to be one of the most racist lines that Lovecraft ever committed to paper, and that's really saying a lot, which basically is that by the end of that story, the main character is like, well, we examined this woman's body after death, and we found out that in deceitfully slight proportion, Marcelin was a negress. And he says it as though that's worse than the fact that she was also a sorceress whose hair detached from her head and went around strangling people by itself like some enormous hair spider.
Sort of like Medusa. Yeah, I mean, exactly like Medusa.
Yeah, exactly like Medusa. So when Silvia Moreno-Garcia approached me to be part of She Walks in Shadows, her idea was that we should take actual Lovecraftian texts and spin them, and to some degree take female monsters and redeem them and make them the central characters. And I was like, yeah, okay, Medusa's Coil. I want to do that with Marcelin Bedard de Russy. What I like about it is that in the story, Marcelin is already dead. She has no voice, literally. She is just this predatory, alien, subhuman monster that some poor dude married and brought over from France, and oh, everything just fell to crap after that. And what people kind of gloss over is the fact that Marcelin is fairly obviously biracial. I think it's entirely likely that she might actually be related to the de Russys. And the de Russys live on a plantation where they were once huge slave owners. They don't have any slaves anymore because, unfortunately, that pleasant institution has been discontinued. I swear to God, pleasant institution. I have a copy which I got secondhand, and somebody has underlined that line and written in the margin, pleasant, question mark, question mark, question mark.
So those were Lovecraft. That was Lovecraft's phrase.
That was Lovecraft,
pleasant, yeah. Pleasant institution.
Yeah, it's that kind of story. You know, Lovecraft is like, oh, these poor, sad, noble former slave owners, you know, preyed upon by the dregs of humanity. And I'm like, man, I want to take that and do the 12 years a slave version where you come out the back of it and you're like, the Derussis deserved everything they got.
Well, let's hear a bit from that story. And I know you've brought along a copy of it, and we've picked out a passage. Do you need to set up this passage at all?
This is about the first time that Marceline, who is the narrator, meets the man who is going to become her husband and who is her cousin. A morning sampler, embroidered in 15 different Derussi family members' hair, once hung upstairs, just outside my husband's childhood bedroom door. Such a pretty garden scene at first glance, soft and gracious, depicting the linden tree border separating river and dock from well-manicured green lawn and edging flower beds, that useless clutter of exotic blooms, completely unsuited to local climate or soil, which routinely drank up half the fresh water diverted from the slave quarters' meager vegetable patch. The lindens also performed a second function, of course, making sure Derussi eyes were never knowingly forced to contemplate what their negros called the bone field, a wet clay sump where the slaves' corpses were buried at night and without ceremony once their squeamish masters were safely asleep. Landscaping as maquillage, a false face overwrought, the skull, skin hid. But then we all look the same underneath, no matter our outward shade, n'est-ce pas? In 1912, I took Dennis's hand at a Paris soiree and knew him immediately from my own blood, from the way the very touch of him made my skin crawl. That oh-so-desirable peau si blanche, olive-inflected like old ivory, light enough to shine under candle flame. I had my tannet wig on that night. Coils of it hung down in tiers as far as my hips, my thighs, far enough to brush the very backs of my bare knees. I'd been rehearsing most of the day, preparing to chant the old rites in Shona while doing what my posters called a Rudmus dance for fools with deep pockets. Frank Marsh was there too, of course. His fishy eyes hung out on strings. He introduced Dennis to me, then pulled me aside and begged me once again to allow him to paint me as the gods intended, with only my ancestors' hair from modesty. But I laughed in his face and turned back to Dennis instead, for here was the touch of true fate at last, culmination of my mother's many prayers and sacrifices. Mine to bend myself to him and bind him fast, make him bring me back to Riverside to do what must be done, just as it had been Frank's unwitting destiny to make that introduction all along and suffer the consequences. Antoine Derussi liked to boast he kept Dennis unworldly, and I must suppose it to be so, for he never saw me with my wig off, my tannet locks set by, and the not-so-soft fuzz of black which anchored it on display. As he was raised to think himself a gentleman, it would never have occurred to Dennis to demand such intimacies. By the time his father pressed him to do so, I had him well trained. Something odd about that woman, boy, I heard him whisper more than once before they fell out. Makes my blood run cold to see it. For all she's foreign-born, I'd almost swear I know her face. Ha! As though the man had no memory or no mirrors. Yet I was far too fair for the one, I suspect, and far too different, though in deceitfully slight proportion, to quote that northerner who wrote your vaunted testimony, for the other, it being difficult to acknowledge your own features in so alien a mirror, not even when they come echoing back to you over generations of mixed blood, let alone on your only son's arm.
Oh, that is great. Thank you. So the idea of black women's hair looms large in your story. And of course, black hair is an important part of black history. Can you talk about how you used that in your story?
The hair, Marceline's tannet Isis wig, is her most powerful magical tool, and it definitely preserves her intelligence after death. It's made out of the hair of her ancestors, symbolizing the revenge of generation of slaves, tormented and killed on the Derussi plantation, especially the ones like Marceline's mother, who essentially are Derussis because they were forced to have sex with and bear children by Derussi men. And part of Marceline's deceptiveness in Lovecraft's eyes is that you can't just look at her and recognize that she has African blood. A key portion of that probably comes from the wig, this very long white-looking pile of hair that's not rough enough to necessarily read as black. And the idea of having good hair is a really old one in African American culture. Chris Rock did a whole documentary about it. It's an intersectional issue. It's a standard of beauty by which women inside the community feel policed by popular culture, but also one that people inside the community use to police each other, especially when they're biracial, like Marceline. So the wig is a symbol of what they call misogynoir, but also of the capitalist issue that there's an entire multi-million dollar industry built around encouraging black women to hate the way their hair looks naturally. And most recently, we've seen this called out on TV shows like How to Get Away with Murder, on which Viola Davis made people very uncomfortable by taking her wig off in front of the camera as a sign of vulnerability, and Empire, where the main characters are always criticizing each other's weaves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that you're dealing with here is you're sort of playing with this notion of miscegenation. I mean, the mixing of different races, which runs throughout Lovecraft's work. And I mean, of course, he was horrified by it. And this is very prominent in your story as well. But you're taking quite a different approach. I mean, you're not using this in a racist way at all.
I like to hope I'm not doing that. The fact is that, you know, I was born in England and I was raised in Canada, and I am as white as a sack of sheets. And I have to cop to that. If somebody says me writing in Marceline's voice is cultural appropriation, all I can ever say is, well, yes, you're right.
Do you have to think twice about that? I mean, you being a white woman writing in a black voice?
What I try to do is to own it and say, these are the choices that I'm making. And I try to open myself up and try to make sure that when I write a character like Marceline, I'm not making her say things. I am, to some degree, and this sounds ridiculous, it sounds kind of, you know, spooky, like, oh, I open myself up and the muses come into me. But, you know, opening myself up and letting her speak for herself.
No, I would think another approach would have been just to write the story, but just to forget about Lovecraft. I mean, why refer back to him? Why try to invert the Lovecraft racism and to turn it into a different kind of story where the politics work? Why not just forget about Lovecraft?
A lot of people say that. A lot of people are sort of like, well, Lovecraft was a sad old white man. Throw him away. Throw him away with the trash. And the problem is that the tendrils of Lovecraft's influence are really everywhere in not just old school horror, but modern horror as well. The things that he came up with have infiltrated every level of horror as it exists. And I think in much the same way that you should not allow people to write school books that call slaves immigrants or migrant workers, you know? People came from all over the world to work in America. Well, yeah, because they were sold here. The hell, you know? I mean, in the same way that you shouldn't be allowed to do that, you should not be allowed to forget who Lovecraft was, in both senses of the word, that he was a guy whose imagination was amazing in some ways. I cling to the idea that horror is not a niche market. Horror is, in fact, something that is very basic and very understandable for everyone. A lot of people don't want to think about the things that horror faces all the time, but they are utterly bedrock human things like mortality and loss and sorrow and rage and hatred. And that's at the heart of Lovecraft. It's basic human stuff. And when we reject Lovecraft and say, throw him on the trash heap, we don't have to deal with him anymore, we reject the fact that part of our own composition is the urge to look at other people and say, I'm human and you're not. I'm a real person and you're not.
Gemma Files is an award-winning Canadian horror writer. Her work is featured in a new anthology called She Walks in Shadows. Women Writers Reimagine Lovecraft's Mythos. Steve Paulson talked with her.